Thus, while kneading heartwood, he cut off the inner bark and took it away, thinking it was heartwood. Whatever it was, this good man had to make with heartwood, his purpose will not be served. Suppose a man needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, came to a great tree standing, possessed of heartwood. Passing over the heartwood, he would cut off the sapwood and take it away, thinking it was heartwood. Then a man with good sight, seeing him, might say, this good man did not know the heartwood. Thus, while kneading heartwood, he cut off the sapwood and took it away, thinking it was heartwood. Whatever it was this good man had to make with heartwood, his purpose will not be served. Suppose a man needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, came to a great tree standing, possessed of heartwood. Cutting off only its heartwood, he would take it away, knowing it was heartwood. Then a man with good sight, seeing him, might say, this good man knew the heartwood, the sapwood, the inner bark, the outer bark, and the twigs and leaves. Thus, while needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, he came to a great tree standing, possessed of heartwood, and cutting only its heartwood, he took it away, knowing it was heartwood. Whatever it was this good man had to make with heartwood, his purpose will be served. So too, Brahman, here some clansmen go forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness, considering, I'm a victim of birth, aging, and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. I'm a victim of suffering, prey to suffering. Surely an ending of this whole mass of suffering can be known. When he's gone forth thus, he acquires gain, honor, and renown. He is pleased with gain, honor, and renown, and his intention is fulfilled. On account of it, he lauds himself and disparages others. I have gain, honor, and renown, but these other monks are unknown, of no account. So he arouses no desire to act. He makes no effort for the realization of those other states that are higher and more sublime than gain, honor, and renown. He hangs back and slackens. I say that this person is like the man needing heartwood, who came to a great tree standing possessed of heartwood, passing over the heartwood, its sapwood, its inner bark and outer bark. He cut off its twigs and leaves and took them away, thinking they were heartwood. So whatever it was he had to make with heartwood, his purpose will not be served. Being a Westerner, when I ordained in 1986, all of a sudden I put on the robes and I was incredibly famous. People were coming around, they wanted to mostly stare because I didn't speak any Thai. And even I went from Bangkok to Chiang Mai to meet a friend. When I got off the train, there was newspaper people, and they were filming me get off the train, and it wound up on television. They that was truly remarkable. But I'm not interested in that kind of stuff. Who cares? So that's one of the things that can catch monks, and they can become very famous for a short period of time if they don't continue on with the practice. Here, monk, some clansmen go forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness, considering, I'm a victim of birth, aging, and death, of sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. I'm a victim of suffering, a prey to suffering. Surely an ending to this whole mass of suffering can be known. When he had gone forth thus, he acquires gain, honor, and renown. He's not pleased with gain, honor, and renown, and his intention is not fulfilled. He does not, on account of it, laud himself and disparage others. He arouses desire to act and makes an effort for the realization of those other states that are higher and more sublime than gain, honor, and renown. He does not hang back and slacken. He achieves the attainment of virtue. He is pleased with the attainment of virtue. And his intention is fulfilled. On account of which he lauds himself and disparages others. I'm virtuous, of good character, but these other monks are immoral, of evil character. So he arouses no desire to act. He makes no effort for the realization of those states that are higher and more sublime than the attainment of virtue. He hangs back and slackens. I say that this person is like a man needing heartwood, passing over the heartwood, its sapwood, its inner bark, cuts its outer bark, and takes it away, thinking it was heartwood. So whatever he had in mind to make with the heartwood, his purpose will not be served. Here, Brahman, some clansmen go forth out of faith from home life into homelessness, considering I'm a victim of birth, aging, and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. I'm a victim of suffering, a prey to suffering. Surely an ending of this whole mass of suffering can be known. When he has gone forth thus, he acquires gain, honor, and renown. He's not pleased with gain, honor, and renown, and his intention is not fulfilled. He achieves the attainment of virtue. He's pleased with the attainment of virtue, but his intention is not fulfilled. He does not, on account of it, laud himself and disparage others. And he rouses desire to act and makes an effort for the realization of those other states that are higher and more sublime than the attainment of virtue. He does not hang back and slacken. He achieves the attainment of collectedness. He is pleased with the attainment of collectedness, and his intention is fulfilled, on account of which he lauds himself and disparages others. I'm collected, my mind is unified. But these monks are uncollected, and their minds go astray. So he arouses no desire to act. He makes no effort for the realization of those other things that are higher and more sublime than the attainment of collectedness. We're talking about not meditation yet, but being able to listen to a Dhamma talk without moving your body. Being able to focus on what you're reading without distractions coming in, that kind of collectedness. He hangs back and he slackens. I say that this person is like a man kneading heartwood, who passing over the heartwood and its sapwood cut off the inner bark and took it away, thinking it was hardwood. And whatever it was he had to make with heartwood, his purpose will not be served. Hear, Brahman, some clansmen go forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness, considering, I'm a victim of birth, aging, and death, of sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. I'm a victim of suffering, a prey to suffering. Surely an ending of this whole mass of suffering can be known. When he's gone forth thus, he acquires gain, honor, and renown. He's not pleased with gain, honor, and renown, and his intention is not fulfilled. He achieves the attainment of virtue. He's pleased with the attainment of virtue, but his intention is not fulfilled. He achieves the attainment of collectedness. He is pleased with the attainment of collectedness, but his intention is not fulfilled. He does not, on account of it, laud himself and disparage others. He arouses desire to act, and he makes an effort for the realization of those other states that are higher and more sublime than the attainment of collectedness. He does not hang back and slacken. He achieves knowledge and vision. He's pleased with that knowledge and vision, and his intention is fulfilled. On account of which he lauds himself and disparages others. I live knowing and seeing, but these other monks live unknowing and unseeing, so he arouses no desire to act. He makes no effort for the realization of those other states that are higher and more sublime than knowledge and vision. He hangs back and slackens. I say that this person is like a man kneading heartwood, passing over its heartwood, cuts off its sapwood, and took it away thinking it was heartwood. So whatever it was that man had to make with heartwood, his purpose will not be served. Hear, Brahman, some clansman goes forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness, considering, I'm a victim of birth, aging, and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. I'm a victim of suffering, a prey to suffering. Surely an ending of this whole mass of suffering can be known. When he's gone forth thus, he acquires gain, honor, and renown. He's not pleased with gain, honor, and renown, and his intention is not fulfilled. He achieves the attainment of virtue. He's pleased with the attainment of virtue, but his intention is not fulfilled. He achieves the attainment of collectedness. He's pleased with the attainment of collectedness, but his intention is not fulfilled. He achieves knowledge and vision. He's pleased with knowledge and vision, but his intention is not fulfilled, and he does not, on account of that, laud himself and disparage others. He arouses desire to act and makes an effort for the realization of those other states that are higher and more sublime than knowledge and vision. He does not hang back and slacken. But what, Brahman, are the states that are higher and more sublime than knowledge and vision? Here, Brahman, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, a monk enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by thinking and examining thought with joy and happiness born of seclusion. This is a state higher and more sublime than knowledge and vision. The knowledge and vision they're talking about is like the Bodhisattva when he went to the different meditation teachers and he memorized all of the teaching. And he said, I know and see. But he didn't have the actual experience of it yet. So this is talking about book learning. Again, with the stilling of thinking and examining thought, a monk enters upon and abides in the second jhana, which has self-confidence and singleness of mind, without thinking and examining thought, with joy and happiness born of collectedness. This is a state higher and more sublime than knowledge and vision. Again, with the fading away of joy, a monk abides in equanimity, mindful and fully aware, still feeling happiness with the body. He enters upon and abides in the third jhana, on account of which noble ones announce, he has a pleasant abiding, who has equanimity and is mindful. This too is a state higher and more sublime than knowledge and vision. Again, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, a monk enters upon and abides in the fourth jhana, which has neither pleasure nor pain, and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. This too is a state higher and more sublime than that knowledge and vision. Again, with the complete surmounting of gross perceptions of form, with the disappearance of gross perceptions of sensory impact, aware that space is infinite, a monk enters upon and abides in the base of infinite space. This too is a state higher and more sublime than knowledge and vision. This is the state where the loving kindness changes to compassion. And that is the state that the Buddha sat in every morning for a couple hours. And it's called compassion with infinite space. But as time went by, especially the Mahayana, changed it to infinite compassion. And that's a phrase that sounds great, but it doesn't really say much. But compassion with infinite space says a lot. This is where your body disappears. You just feel your head. And if you put your attention on your body, you will feel it. Don't do that. You don't need to check out what your body is doing. It's all mental now. We're in the immaterial realms. Again, by completely surmounting the base of infinite space, aware that consciousness is infinite, a monk enters upon and abides in the base of infinite consciousness. This too is a state higher and more sublime than knowledge and vision. I had one student that she got into that state, and she was out walking, and I saw her stamping her feet down as she was walking. I went over to her and I said, "What are you doing?" And she said, "Well, I can't feel my feet. I can't feel my body very much. And when I step real hard, then I can feel it." So, oh. I said, "Okay, but you shouldn't be doing that. You should stay with the joy," because that's what she was experiencing at that time, "and start noticing at the sense doors the blinking, very fast arising, passing away of consciousnesses." At when she started doing that, she was the person that told me that when she was sitting in meditation, it felt like her head was on the floor, and that's all there was. And she came to me that afternoon, and she said, "You know, seeing all these consciousnesses arise and pass away, it's really tiresome because they're all doing it. All of the different sense doors, they're arising and passing away. That's all there is." And I said, "Oh, does that mean that you're noticing that things are a little bit more impermanent than you thought they were?" "Oh, yeah." "Oh, and the tiresomeness, would you call that a form of suffering?" "Absolutely." "Did you see that there was no controller? You can't make it happen? You have no control over which one of the sense doors is going to appear, and you have no control over seeing them arise and pass away continually." "So that means that you're seeing anatta. You're seeing the impersonal nature of everything." "Oh, yeah." The next day she came to me and she was really, really afraid. A lot of fear came up, and she said, My mind said that I might as well just die right now." And I said, "Good." She said, "Well, you want me to die?" I said, "No, I'm saying good because you're letting go of the idea of a personal self." And then I started laughing, saying something to the effect of, "All of these lifetimes that you've experienced in the past, you've always thought your mind was in control of it all, and now you're seeing it's not. That's really great." "Well, I still feel like I'm going to die." "We'll laugh and it'll go away. It's nothing." And it did. This is the true experience of anicca, dukkha, anatta. And as you go deeper in your meditation, you start seeing even more subtle forms of this. "By completely surmounting the base of infinite consciousness, aware that there is nothing, a monk enters upon and abides in the base of nothingness. This too is a state higher and more sublime than knowledge and vision." So when you get deeper into your meditation, you get into a place where mind stops looking outside itself. And you start seeing the importance of learning how to balance the amount of energy you use when you're staying with your object of meditation, which now is equanimity, very strong. Your mind doesn't get excited about stuff. It just says, oh, okay. And generally, when you get deep into it, I can tell just by your voice where you are, because your voice has no excitement in it at all. How are you doing today? Fine. Everything is fine. You having fun? Everything is fine. So your mind becomes very, very, very peaceful and calm. And you start recognizing that if you put a little bit too much attention on your object of meditation, you start to get restless. And if you don't put quite enough, then you start to get dull. You don't get sleepy anymore at this stage. You have to adjust tiny little bits. It's not any big push to make yourself stay with the balanced mind, with your object of meditation. Now, this is generally, when you get deep enough, this is generally when I'm going to tell you that your mind, when you're on your object of meditation, your mindfulness slips a little bit, and mind starts moving and starts wobbling a little bit. As soon as you know that, notice that movement or wobble, then you 6R right then, your mind just stays on your object of meditation. But there's something that happens before the wobble. And that's what I want you to see. And describe it to me. I'm not going to tell you. Now, for some people, when they have a sensitive mind to feeling, they can start having things come up that are really fantastic, memories of past lifetimes, lights, all kinds of different phenomena. They're nothing. It's just your mind trying to distract you away from staying on your object of meditation. So you stay with your object of meditation, and if it doesn't pull your attention away, you don't pay attention to it. Again, I want to remind you that the 6 R's are not to control anything. If some kind of feeling comes up, you notice, you 6R, you come back to your object of meditation. That feeling might be there for a while. Doesn't matter. Your job is to keep backing away, so you're just the observer. There's nothing you need to make happen. There's nothing that you need to try to control. Nothing. 6R. Let it be. As you get better and better at this, and you relax into it, there can be some distracting thought that comes in. It doesn't pull your attention away anymore, but it's still there. Ignore it. It'll go away by itself. Mind has a tendency to try to help you at a certain point in the meditation, and especially when you first sit. Like you've just gone out and did a nice walk, and then you sat. And you start radiating to the 6 directions, and your mind is jumping all over the place. So you have to 6R, come back and do it again. Sometimes that'll happen for a whole hour. And then when your mindfulness is strong enough, it'll just stop. And then you'll be able to sit for a long period of time with no movement of mind's attention, but you're still radiating that feeling of equanimity. By completely surmounting the base of nothingness, a monk enters upon and abides in the base of neither perception nor non-perception. This too is a state higher and more sublime than knowledge and vision. So what we're talking about here is you'll get into such a deep state that you can't really tell whether you're in a state or not. And it's like being asleep and being aware at the same time. We're talking about subtle states now. So what you want to do is, when you're in that state, and then you come out, then reflect on what happened while you were in that state. Neither perception or non-perception is very, very, very subtle. But when you reflect on what happened when you come out of that state, then you'll see colors, you'll see patterns, shapes, things like that. 6R those. And then you'll sit for a long period of time without any movement of mind's attention at all. Maybe 45 minutes, an hour, maybe even longer. Don't break your sitting. Don't stop. I had 3 years of trying to convince one lady that when you're in that state, it's good to be in that state. Don't break it. She'd sit for an hour and she'd say, well, there's nothing happening, I might as well get up and start doing stuff. Aye, that drove me crazy. But the thing that got me to convince her not to do that is she's an Indonesian woman. She has been a Buddhist her whole life. And she understands about making merit. And I finally told her that when she's sitting without any movement of mind's attention, she was making the highest merit that she possibly could make, because there's no disturbance. And that got her convinced. And then she would sit for longer, 3 hours, 4 hours, like that. But what you're going to see, because your mind is so quiet, there's no movement of mind's attention at all. You're taking mind, that quiet mind, as your object of meditation. This is the only time that you don't have another object of meditation. The equanimity fades away by itself now. Just this quiet mind. It's exquisite. There's no other way to describe it. It's really nice to sit for an hour and not have any disturbance. But then you'll start to notice that there is some slight disturbance that occurs. And as soon as you notice that movement, then 6R. Mind is incredibly sneaky and will try to throw things up that will distract you away from staying with that still mind. But you just let it go after you've 6R'd. When you come out of the meditation, right before you come all the way out, then you start reflecting on what happened while you were in that state. And relax, relax. Let go. Okay. By completely surmounting the base of neither perception nor non-perception, a monk enters upon and abides in the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness. Now, you don't know you're in that state until you've come out of it. At first, it doesn't last for very long. Maybe, 5 or 10 minutes. But time means nothing to you at that time. When you come out of that state, right as you're just starting to have your perception, feeling, and consciousness arise, you're going to see little tiny things that arise and pass away very quickly. And that is your seeing and realizing the dependent origination. You're going to see it all on your own. And right after that, you will have an immeasurably strong feeling of relief. And you feel a change happen in your mind. And you will be happy. You walk around grinning and all kinds of stuff. And that you come and tell me about it, and I'll explain what your experience was at that time. And then I'm going to tell you, good, go sit. You feel really happy. You don't feel like sitting. But there's still more to do. So you need to go and sit. See, what you've just experienced is called path knowledge. But that is not set in you until there is the fruition knowledge, which is again going back into that neither perception nor non-perception state and keep going deeper and deeper, and it will happen again. And it will be like the same experience, only a little bit stronger. Then you have become a sotapanna with fruition. When you get the fruition, the most times you'll ever be reborn is 7. You will not break any precepts. The idea of saying something that's not true can still come up into your mind. But your mind will say, why do I want to say something that's not true? And just let it go. You no longer have any doubt arise that this is the right path. Up until then, you still have some little doubts. Am I doing this right? Is this what he meant? These kind of things. Now you have real confidence. And you also see that rites and rituals don't lead to nibbana. There's a lot of Buddhism, there is a lot of rites and rituals. And a lot of strange beliefs that don't really match up what the Buddha said. When I was in Malaysia, I was dealing a lot with Chinese. In Kuala Lumpur, they were from the area in China, the Hokkien area. And they had their own strange little beliefs in the way that they did things, which I didn't really mess with too much. But they also had this belief that when you chant, you don't have to know what you're chanting. It's the vibration. And this man came, and he, with no small amount of pride, came to me and he said, I've been chanting every day for 7 years, the same thing over and over again. Do you want to hear me chant it? I said, okay, sure. So he chanted for about 5 minutes. And then he stopped, and I said, well, okay, what does that mean? He said, mean? Well, yeah, you're chanting this. You should know what you're saying, right? Well, no, it's the vibration that's most important. So I told him, well, why don't you go home and practice saying banana over and over again? At least you know what a banana is. He didn't appreciate that very much. The whole point of Buddhism is understanding. And if you're going to do something blindly, well, pick a word that you know what it means, rather than this mystical, magical idea of something special is going to happen because I chant. So you know beyond a shadow of a doubt that that kind of stuff doesn't lead to nibbana. And you know beyond a shadow of a doubt that everything that arises is impersonal. This is where a kind of nice personality development happens. Where somebody would do something and you would be upset for a period of time and be highly emotional and that sort of thing. What happens is you start catching it quicker and you start having the thought, why am I doing this to myself? Why don't we just not have that emotional thing? And all life becomes more beneficial, not only for you, but for everybody around you. Now, one of the true advantages of becoming a sotapanna is that when you die, you will be very aware of what's happening. I was with one student that died, and he was a pretty advanced meditator. And as I was talking with him, he said, now I don't have any feeling in my feet. Now I don't have any feeling in my knees. Now I don't have any feeling in my back. And he kept going until he got to his heart, and then he died. Very peaceful. Very nice. You're not ever going to be reborn lower than a human being. That's how powerful the merit is that you get when you become a sotapanna. And the era that we're in right now is called the era of the saints. You become a saint when you become a sotapanna. But it's a heck of a lot different than the Catholic beliefs in sainthood and that sort of thing. This is a true personality development. As you continue to go deeper, you start seeing how past behavior caused so much pain and suffering, not only in you but other people, that you start becoming more aware and you start backing off. You don't get so off the handle emotional. You still go through your moments. But as you continue on, what I tell people to do when they get to that stage is, now you start your meditation with equanimity. And you do the six directions, and then radiate equanimity to all the different beings in all directions, and then your mind will go into this deeper state where it's completely still. And basically the same thing happens again. You'll feel your mind go deeper and deeper, and all of a sudden it blanks. There's a blank there. And then when you come out of that state, you will see these little rising and passing away, but there's many more of them. Then you have gotten into the second stage of awakening called Sakadagami. Big relief, a lot of happiness, you understand what you're doing a lot more clearly, you understand how mind works more easily, you don't have so much excitement in your mind anymore. You still have little moments, brief moments of lust arising. And hatred arising, but these are very weak. So you keep going with your practice, and eventually you'll get to another place where there's another blank, and when you come out you'll see the links of dependent origination again, and then you'll have fulfilled the requirement for fruition. And when you get into the fruition, you feel your mind change again, and it becomes much more balanced, much, much more at ease with everything. This is called a once-returner. When you die, you're going to be reborn one more time, wherever you're reborn, either in a Brahmaloka or Devaloka or human being. But you will become an arahat in that lifetime. And then there is no more becoming. So, as you continue on with your practice, you again have that blank spot, and then you see many more, and you're starting to recognize more easily the links of dependent origination, how they arise, how they cease. And you'll see that three times. When that happens again, you have a few days of real strong happiness. your mind becomes much more clear. Nothing is going to shake your mind up. Your mind is going to be filled with loving kindness, collectedness, and mindfulness, and that's it. You're still going to have some thoughts coming through. You still have a little bit of pride, hot stuff, because I got to this stage. But it's real small. But no more lust or hatred will ever arise in your mind again. Think of the relief of that. No more hatred. No more lust for sensual pleasures. You know, the favorite foods you used to eat and really relish, now they're just food. No big deal. But your mind is so uplifted all the time, that's a much more desirable state to be in than having these little attachments for food or sights or sounds or whatever it happens to be. And of course, I'm going to tell you to continue on, but now you come and talk to me about your meditation, I don't really have anything to say to you. You know what you're doing. You know very well what you're doing. So you come and you start telling me about your practice, and I say, well, try this. Yeah, I know. Okay, why did you come? Why are you here? You know what you're doing. You don't need me. You don't need me to talk with you anymore at all, because you're doing the practice the way you know is right. So it's a real interesting phenomena. And quite fun, actually. It's fun to be around people that never get angry. I have one student that he has a 3-year-old son. And every night, he takes the 3-year-old son, sits down, and he starts talking about loving kindness and feeling that warm feeling. And then out loud he starts wishing happiness for mom and dad and all the relatives, anybody he can think of. And he does it every night with this little 3-year-old boy. Being a householder and having that kind of a personality, what a blessing it is for the children. Because they mimic everything that we do and say. You know, you get into your cursing, you get into your emotional upsets, and they see that, and they mimic it at some point. But when you're with somebody that has a really nicely balanced mind, well, that is absolutely wonderful, what lessons you give. And they know that they're loved. Because they're the person that's an anagami, their heart is open. And there's no doubt in the child's mind that they are completely taken care of and completely loved without any conditions on that love. I'll love you if you're good. No, I'm going to love you anyway. So there's some real advantages to practicing like this. And eventually you let go of the other fetters. You still have, as even when you get to be an anagami with fruition, you still have a little bit of restlessness, a little bit of sloth and torpor, a little bit of conceit, thinking you're pretty good stuff, and you still have a slight desire to be reborn in another realm. And you will be born in another realm, but never again as a human being. If you don't go any higher, you will be reborn in a Brahma Loka that is filled with beings that have done the same thing. From there, you'll become an Arahat. When you die from that realm, then there is no more becoming. So this state of the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness, it can come up at just about any time. It seems to me that there's something magical about washing dishes, because I've had three or four students that were washing dishes and they feel their mind just going and then they stop washing dishes and go sit down for a little while and then they have this experience. I don't know what it is about something like that. So when you continue on with the meditation and you happen to go deeper in your meditation and have this happen again, you become an Arahat. When you become an Arahat, it's decision time. Now, the becoming an Arahat means that you don't ever have any ignorance. You never have any craving arise in your mind again, but you need to be in the safety of the Sangha. You need the purity of the Sangha, or else you will die in 7 days. And I've had some students here that they were getting real close to doing that. And I started thinking, oh boy, I got to hustle around now. I got to get a sangha. There has to be at least 5 monks. There has to be an area that we can do this. And that would be, it's called a sema. We consecrate certain areas that we can do our monk activities in. So I'd really have to hustle around to get it all arranged so that they could become a monk. So there's no more living in the household life when you are a monk or when you are an Arahat. You have to be in the ropes. And I told these people that were getting real close to it, I said, I want you to become an Arahat so you can teach me. So, and of course you have the fruition experience and then you're completely pure being, and their mind is such that you ask them a question, it's going to come right through them, the answer. So it's a real advantage being around an Arahat. If I have to make them myself, I want to do it so that I can learn from them. Because I haven't found any. I searched all over Asia. Every time I heard that this monk or that monk was an Arahat, I went and spent time with them. And then I would see that they'd have a little flash of dissatisfaction or a little flash of desire for some sense pleasure. And then I would go, okay, I'll see you later. I've got to go. Because you're not an arahat if you have any of that kind of thing arise. So, we'll finish the sutta. Okay. And his distractions were destroyed by his seeing with wisdom. This too is a state higher and more sublime than knowledge and vision. These are the states that are higher and more sublime than knowledge and vision. I say that this person, Brahman, is like a person needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, who came to a great tree standing, possessed of heartwood, and cutting off its heartwood, took it away, knowing it was heartwood. And so whatever it was that he had to make with heartwood, his purpose will be served. So this holy life, Brahman, does not have gain, honor, and renown for its benefit, or the attainment of virtue for its benefit, or the attainment of collectedness for its benefit, or knowledge and vision for its benefit. But it is this unshakable deliverance of mind that is the goal of this holy life, its heartwood and its end. When this was said, the Brahman said to the Blessed One, Magnificent Master Gotama, Magnificent. Master Gotama has made the Dhamma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms. I go to Master Gotama for refuge and the Dhamma and to the Sangha of monks. From today, Master Gotama, remember me as a lay follower who has gone to him for refuge for life. So now you know all about heartwood. Do you have any questions?
Why do you die in 7 days if you become an arahat?
Just what happens. I don't know how to answer that. You need the purity of the Sangha. You have to be in the Sangha to continue. There are people that became arahats and they decided that they didn't want to take on the robes. The Buddha's father was one. He became an arahat. He had a very sickly body. He was close to death anyway. So he just said, well, no sense in hanging around anymore. So he died as a layman. Yeah.